So hello and welcome to another Future Pharmacist Conference session. So this session is, I'm excited about every session, obviously, but this one's a special one. So this one's called The Future of Community Pharmacy. And as you can see, we're joined by like really, really dear friend and colleague, Ari Williams. And by way of introduction, not that he needs an introduction in pharmacy circles, but I'm going to anyway. So Ari is superintendent pharmacist at Bedminster Pharmacy in Bristol, also part of the prescribing clinical team at Broadmead Medical Practice, a local GP, so that's a local GP surgery, and he's an associate non-executive director of the Northeast Bristol Trust. That's plenty to keep you going, Ari. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. And it's lovely, lovely to be part of your conference.
It's dead exciting, yeah. I mean, we're well into it now, and it's our first one. It's daunting, flash scary, but the conversations have been very interesting, and every speaker has so far really, really liked the fact that I banned PowerPoint, because I just didn't want it to be that kind of a thing. So
I think it's also really credit to you, your particular style and your real interest in people discussing ideas and creating a space for us to have mature conversations as well. You know, you're a progressive thought leader, and I think when people like you do things, what it does is it carries everybody else along, even when we didn't know we needed to be moved along.
That's very kind. My wife would disagree. Poor Holly, she has to listen to it. She has to listen to lots of Wittering On and stuff like that. But to be serious, I do agree. Well, I thank you for the compliment. It's very kind. But I do agree with you. I mean, our profession and the future of it is very, very important to me. And as I know, it is important to many others. For me, there's a lot of noise at the moment, and let's, you know, our session's about community pharmacies. There's a lot of noise, but I wondered if you agreed with this point. For me, community pharmacy, and particularly community pharmacist practice, it's all about people. Would you agree?
I think certainly, very much so. At the core part of it is the power of having a locally accessible, highly trained clinician, you know, who is got this expertise on health and well-being, but is also really embedded into the social fabric of those communities there. And I think the power of that, and the power of it to help to bring real great outcomes for the patients, to deliver value for money, is something that we all know when we think about it intellectually, but unfortunately for pharmacy, we have not yet been able to sometimes articulate it as well, and also to be able to demonstrate in a way that that helps to protect that model of practice, demonstrate the value of it. I think there is that in there, but nobody thinks it loses sense. You just need to step into a pharmacy and see those interactions and see there for just 10-5 minutes, whatever your reason, and you think this is really powerful. You know, you see social prescribing in action, you see people's mental health being reinforced, you see the care that is required there, you also see the necessary supply of and diagnosis, you know, supply of medicines appropriately, diagnosis, and you see all of that, and it all just happens all the time, you know, there, you know, and that is very much the heartbeat of that and of the community. And then, of course, there will always be the odd poster telling you that there's a local, you know, choir doing something somewhere. That's it, actually. This is why this is such a bastion of the NHS, yeah, in our communities.
I totally agree. I've always been concerned at the potential culture side of things, you know, the cultural loss that would happen if the community pharmacy network was eroded. You know, it's like the post office. It's, you think of a town or village centre, and you've got your half a dozen service outlets, and community pharmacy is firmly one of them. One of the things I want to ask you about, though, is, I'm going to quote Robbie Burns wrong here, but there's a line in one of his poems, and he said, "Oh, basically, I'm not, as an Irish person, I'm not good enough to do the dialect." But the line goes something like, "Oh, what a gift it is to see others as they see us." So my challenge, I guess, and question is that I think there's a lot of potential groupthink in our profession. And maybe we could be a bit more outward looking. Now, the reason I'm asking you this question is because you're one of the pharmacists, in my opinion, that cuts through that. You've managed to cut through to the mainstream and started to explain what a pharmacist is to the general public. So on that point, what Joe Public walking down the street, if you said to them community pharmacist, what do you think pops into their head?
I think for quite a lot of people, well, for most people, what they will tell you is simply, and this is understandable, is their own interaction and what shapes their interaction. You know, so if you go into there to buy things, you think of it as a retailer of medicines. If you go in mostly to collect medicines, if you go in for services, you think, oh, they provide services. So the narrative is one that varies slightly, but at the core of it is the fact that, you know, people will see the premises as a shop. And I don't think that's a disparaging thing. I think in the past, somehow as a profession, we have felt, or we've felt quite disparaged by people describing where we practice as a shop, for example. But what we haven't done is to let people understand what value our practice brings. So I help you to get better, I help you to stay healthier, I help you to get, you know, access to NHS clinical expertise, which is what I have and my team have. That's really what we should be talking about. And I think too many times we have felt that is a problem, is the shell. But really the measure of what happens in there is what we should really value and treasure. So I like the example about the post office. You know, when the post office network was really under threat, everybody said, oh, because people are sending less parcels. Now, when the banks started closing their branches, you know, then all of a sudden, people then said, we can't lose the post office. It's the connection to services, banking, passport applications. Then, of course, the post office has also had to change that and change people's appreciation and bring in and bring ownership and take in. But the sense was not that the post office itself was something that you could afford to do without. It was because people did not understand what the fabric of a community it is. Now, community pharmacy is the fabric of healthcare in our communities. There is no way around that, simply because it is the one place where you look at every other setting, and we're talking about maybe health inequalities. Now, everybody knows they can go into a community pharmacy. Sometimes we would rather try to get some of them out or keep them away because some of their nefarious activities is not exactly what we... But you know what? That's it. Nobody stands in front of a community pharmacy and thinks, are they going to let me in? So you're ready. So you're thinking, okay, so everybody feels that they can go in. So the opportunity is certainly there. And the question then is, how do we articulate and create a model that delivers for that, for the healthcare system, for our communities, and is also financially sustainable? So I certainly agree with you about that you know, people don't, you know, we ourselves need to be there. And I think we also suffer because quite a lot of us in the profession do not have much understanding of what other colleagues do. And because of that, because of our own intra-professional gaps, we are not able to then coalesce around the core value, bearing in mind that most of the population, when they talk about pharmacy, talk about community pharmacy. Actually, that's the most visible image of our profession. And if we needed to change that image, oh, we needed to change the image and work together to do it. But it was never meant to be a tension or done in a way of trying to play out any sort of a negative stereotype. And I don't think we've done that, but I think we haven't been careful enough and intentional enough about that.
It's interesting. I agree. It's just there's so much within that really, and I do I do see this. I don't know if this is like the culture wars or what, you know. I don't know. I'm interested in, you know, pharmacists, pharmacy teams, and, you know, to quote some of your feedback to me, like a progressive agenda. We're not gonna, you know, we're not going to sort everything on this conversation, but it's a progression towards a more optimistic and sustainable future. And I suppose how the public views us is really, really important. And I like it's interesting how you address that. But sort of putting yourself in a in the pharmacist seat now. You know, from a pharmacist point of view, how do you view yourself? So what, you know, I know it's been coined by a few other people, but to you, what is a community pharmacist?
Oh, to me, it's always been very clear. I always track back to my personal statement when I applied to study pharmacy, and I remember the first line said, "I want to play a professional, caring role in my community." So I have always seen every pharmacist as a clinician, but how that role shapes out simply depends on what my specialty is and what the needs in that situation is. So if I am in an area, for example, where people's biggest health needs are actually mental health, and that's there, then obviously I will, as a clinician or as that healthcare professional, become that person there. And I think for us as a profession, I think we struggle sometimes to really, and I guess maybe it's a fair question to ask us. Do we see ourselves, first of all, as all being clinicians? Is that what you come in to be? Or do you see yourself as a supplier, or do you see yourself as a bridge to not to the clinicians? I'm not the clinician, but I can help you a bit. And if you really need to see the clinic, I think those are kind of, there's an identity crisis, I think, sometimes that exists, because we maybe haven't educated ourselves to understand that your clinical competence is just that. It's a competence. You learn, you spend time, you develop yourself, you gain it, you keep. It's not something that sits with you. It's something that grows. It grows because of need. It grows because of your interest. We haven't maybe developed a model of care around that so well. So what happens is that maybe if you're very aware of your own inadequacy, that plays out in how you practice. Now, sometimes the dispensing element of our roles, even that can be disparaged. But in truth, as a clinician, yeah, you are, we are, we should be the, have expertise in the safe and appropriate use of medicines and the legal responsibility to ensure that that is the case. That is part of that. It's the unique bit that comes out from our training, and that will always remain with us. But actually, that sense of, but I'm not just the medicines guy, is quite important. And I think, and I'm certainly not just the supply guy, but that's also, but it's a core bit. And those are not only, even in themselves, anything to be devalued, but there are things to build on. And I think, sometimes I observe colleagues even in different clinical settings, and they only ever peep in to have to contribute into conversations around the use of medicines. But I'm thinking, no, but you should contribute into the care of the patient. If you position yourself as simply the medicines person, then people think you have nothing else to hide. And over a period of time, what then happens is that you lose the sense of the value that you can add. And even for our patients, no patient comes into contact with us looking for, tell me, how much more medicines can I get? Again, except for the sort that we don't really want to supply them. They want to be unburdened from ill health to well-being. So if we are seen as in when everything else fails, I can always speak to him and I'm sure he will give me a list of things to take and how to take them. That's where we fall. And I think at the core center of this identity crisis that we are facing, almost starts from maybe how we present our profession to people coming in, how we train and develop them, and actually how after they get in, then how we because we and how we also let other members of the health community know what expertise they offer. So we shouldn't really be telling other healthcare professionals, you do know the pharmacists have got clinical expertise. Actually, it doesn't make sense because what did they think we were spending 5 years training for then? If they didn't know that, they should be thinking, why are we not using their clinical expertise? And I think it's that sort of conversations that are not happening. Of course, I'm being very idealistic in this, and I know that there are lots of different segues in. But I think my first thing is maybe there is a sense of us really also sorting out our own identity and being able to own that. And then looking at why do how when we then project that out is different. But I think internally we're still not really there. And then the conflicts of corporate governance sometimes also come into that. And then, so we are losing things that many of us don't even know we already inherently have. So we're saying, oh, I want to be able to practice independently as a clinician and not have my decisions influenced just by commercial pressure. Actually, you already that's where you start from. So don't lose it. You start from it. But can you then model the care and make it commercially viable? Well, actually, that's the opportunity, in there. But it's not that we have to trade one for the other.
I totally agree, and there's so much, as you say, there's so much within that, so we'll need to pick a few strands. But on a sort of technical level, I think there's a lack of infrastructure in community pharmacy to support training, development, ongoing progression towards advanced practice. For example, one thing that needs to happen is we need to have a consultant pharmacist in community pharmacy. That's something that needs to happen. And once we have that sort of direction of travel and it becomes baked in, as it were, then that whole process of progression and constant ongoing development becomes normal, doesn't it? And I think the more sort of diligent and enthusiastic community pharmacists, like probably like ourselves, would well, I don't know about diligent, but more enthusiastic anyway. Let's say that. We would engineer opportunities for ourselves to progress, but I wonder, are we in the minority? Are we in a group of early adopters to
That's
things and that kind of thing? I'm not sure.
and I think that worries me. You see, and I'll tell you why. When I look at the future the community pharmacy has to grasp, I inherently see what needs to change. Some of those things need to change quite quickly. Some of those are the journeys, the progressive journeys that we need to make. And the first one is I don't yet hear or see a real sort of urgency in terms of defining what community pharmacy is. I see a lot of events. I see opportunities coming out of other people's crises and needs, but I don't see a lot of things come from intelligent, deliberate design with policy and evidence saying that. And it is actually not using just the expertise that there because I some of the things that community pharmacy does do, I could argue that if you picked another healthcare professional or non-healthcare professional, gave them a certain level of training, can they do this or not? And I think we got to be careful in that sense of thinking, well, if legally it's not legally defined, it's not a character of the profession. Well, so actually technically we're doing it, but anybody else could also do it. So But I think that's where we're now coming into that design and deliberate progression into that. To come and say, well, the profession is changing, and every profession changes. There is no, it's not just about nostalgic holding on, but it is actually about holding this progressive sort of vision that we all need to buy into. Now, events though are happening. So constantly, political pressures, pressures in healthcare, pressures in workforce planning, pressures in then those things lend themselves to a profession like ours, where because if you kind of just keep raising your hand for me, rightly so, because nobody then anytime somebody says, well, how about this one? Have a go at it. Yeah, but if you do it well, do we remember? But that's just something I can do. That's not really my core value. Because at some point, people unfortunately only denote your core value from what you do. Okay? So we all go to schools of pharmacy and we all say, pharmacy, community pharmacy, for example, is not about dispensing. We go, no, I don't. But in truth, if you did a audit of your time, that's what you spend most of your time doing.
Yeah,
And
well,
then but then you also speak, we also do other things. And I think that's it. We also play, those patient interactions, like I said. And I think we just need to make sure that we, because once you start to identify your core values, you then also start to protect them.
Yeah, no, totally agree. I think we've got to get honest and get to the nitty-gritty here and say that, there's a lot of box moving in community pharmacy, isn't there? Got to be honest with that. Your point there about the reality of what it, I think what you're sold when you come out of, the dream of Hepler and Strand and, pharmaceutical care and all the rest of it. And then you sort of actually go to a community pharmacy, and it's pretty tough, So I think we've got to set the context there. There is a lot there, it's tough for community pharmacy at the moment, but there's still an awful lot of money around. And I do believe there's good money to be made. I think it's uncertain times. Hand on heart, would I now I can call myself a business person. As a business person, would I look forward 15 years, 20 years, and invest in a community pharmacy in Scotland? It would be as a one-off invest, as my only investment. I'm not sure. As part of a wider portfolio, if I was loaded, which I'm not, yeah, probably it would be quite good for the long term, but. So you've got to think with that. And the other thing I think we need to recognize, and welcome your view on this, Addy, but I think it was Darren Baines at one stage highlighted the fact that the community pharmacy network, across the UK, I think it's fair enough to generalize, is in a lazy economy. So they get the lion's share, they get enough money from one source, i.e. the NHS, to not have to worry too much about, worries about, that's a it's probably not a fair turn of phrase, but you see my point. They get enough money from one source to not have to pivot yet. And I suppose I should probably explain the lens through which I see this and the reason why I don't have much sympathy for a business that refuses to Not refuses, but is reluctant or speaks to that lazy economy concept and doesn't change, because the little business that I run, i.e. Pip, there's total jeopardy all of the time. So much so that I still do the odd locum to top things up, So I don't know, is it a contra I don't want to sort of hack anyone off here or upset anyone, but is there an entitlement in community pharmacy? I was just going to say, I find the narrative around, and we published an article a few years ago about nationalizing the community pharmacy network. I certainly wouldn't be in favor of that. I think that's too far. But there is this sort of pseudo, are we part of the NHS or not? And And at one, it often, I welcome your thoughts on this, but it often depends on the political cycle, you know, where we're at.
I think you know the point that I would come to this from is when you look at the profile of certainly for most English pharmacies, and I don't think it's going to differ much from across the country. You know, averagely, I'll say about 90, 85, 90% of their, you know, their income, their turnover, and you know, is related to NHS funded activity. That is by simply because of the fact that that is where their greatest demand is. That is their biggest client. So that embeds them into the NHS. And it's, you know, it does come with that sense of, you know, we will say the insecurity, although you would, you know, in terms of the fluctuation in the how the funding settlements land and what you are required to do to be able to, you know, to get paid from that paymaster. And for many people, you know, the first thing is, you know, you get paid for dispensing, for example. But you have now more so opportunities though to maybe deliver services, and that comes with its own pressure. You know, you have to do that. Now, the for in most of the businesses, you will spend quite a bit of your time and energy trying to harness the other funded services. Why? Because you know they are better margins. One, they are better for the profession. And I think in the past, we, you know, that lazy economy you're describing was where we kind of just sometimes would look at those things and you're like, oh, nah, that's not for me. Not now. I'm too busy. You know, and it's, you know, I'm doing
Yeah.
that. I think in truth, I think that's changed, not by design. I think that's changed simply because of the core financial principles of how not as rewarding or sustainable it is to build your, you know, your practice around just dispensing. Now, the other bit is what was the 10%, you know, the private sort of the other things that you did, which was always been about OTC services, private services and things. There is also, you know, now an awareness that, okay, everybody, and you know, anybody you read a book on or listen to about growing or managing the community farm sales, you need to grow that. But to grow that, you need to have some kind of fundamentals that have been sorted out in the 80%. Because for one, if you're not motivated to get paid for the NHS services, you're never really going to do anything about private there. And at the core part of this is actually, now, and this is where it comes into it always comes down to almost the professional satisfaction. And for the pharmacist, now we then end up with those that are just worn out, simply, you know, going to what they will feel is a dispensing factory. There are also some that actually simply are very dismissive of anything else beyond what they're comfortable with and they've always known. Maybe that's dispensing. And then there's another group whose aspirations is really to embrace the clinical, innovative, more cutting edge, more, you know, more patient rewarding aspects of their core competencies that they want to deliver. And for those ones, now those are the ones that tend to move away from our profession. They kind of move on to something else. They move into sorry, our sector. For the ones that are scared, don't want to change, don't, you know, don't want to do anything, they in truth they're scared because what they know, what if, you know, the world has changed around them, and they are insecure in the current environment, but sometimes financially secure enough that they don't feel disrupted. So I think that's maybe where Darren was coming from. And then there's this group of people that are just trying to figure out, how do we make this work? You know, how do I kind of, I know this doesn't work, but this is what I'm spending most of my time from. But then, you know, sometimes you need to then get expertise, maybe buy technology, develop your team, invest there. So we need that professional conversation almost alongside almost the funding streams, like to kind of then start to move us forward. Because I think for too long we've been asking people to make a choice, which camp are you in? And I think majority of people, they want to be in that they want to be in the progressive camp. They want to deliver things that are rewarding for their communities and their patients and use their clinical expertise. For one thing, it gives them a lot of professional satisfaction. But at the same point, if you're only going to get paid, if your core source of income is going to be your dispensing, it's got to underpin it. I think sometimes the conversation is about redistributing it. And so what then happens is if you redistribute it, people then say, well, okay, so I'm going to get paid less for doing that. Okay, so I'll do that then. And I'll find a way to live with less for it. It is a false dichotomy, but I think it's because I feel that we are not the ones shaping those conversations. We, as a profession, I mean, when I say we are not the ones saying what is, because this is what we do. This is not what we do. These are delegated tasks. These are tasks that are core professional values that we need to do. If we are having those conversations, some things, maybe like accuracy checking, for example, most likely would have moved on a lot because, the laws changed. But yet, many of us are still traumatized by the fact that if you ever saw a letter with the GPHC or the regulator on it, the first thing you thought is, what have I done? And you don't normally think, oh, what have they found out? You think, have I made a mistake? And I think it's that. So it is, you're right. I agree with you that, there is this, and I think that inherent laziness, I also say, why did we as a profession not really challenge it? Because my concern is if it is the paymasters that are reshaping your profession, you are then perceived as not being very progressive, actually. So they then think, oh, look, we've changed the way we fought, and now look at them, they're becoming more like this. So then it almost opens people up to think, what more goes on in that place that we may not understand, but let's see, because we could help them to change it. So when people feel as if they're helping you to become a better you, that is never a good place to be. And I feel very much that there are conversations happening around community pharmacy or people helping us to become a better us that we are not the ones shaping. And that worries me.
Yeah, that's such a good point, like about, are we sort of masters or mistresses of our own destiny? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I have to agree with you. I'm not sure we are. And if you dissect, like, that is an interesting conversation around what a profession is. Are we a profession really in the purest sense of the term? I mean, we're doing, look, declare an interest. We're doing vaccination training. We're increasing our training portfolio on PIP, and that's great. I'm starting with vaccinations because I know almost every pharmacy in the UK does some kind of vaccination service, especially at the moment. So it seems like a bit of a no-brainer. But vaccination is more or less a technical task. So, to be holding that up as the highest accolade of professionalism is, it's sort of, it's notch one of 10 for me. I'm not sure we should be hanging our hat on it. It's basically a repetitive task. So
it is.
I was just, I just agree with you. And I think I was just going to say, like, I guess PIP, PIP is, I like to think we exist in our own orbit. Well, me specifically. And sometimes I'll dip in and sometimes I won't. And, any opinions that I've expressed personally over the years have probably matured a lot, but they are very much in the center ground, and they're based on this, as you say, this progressive agenda, working together, leaving no one behind, but not accepting mediocre either. And what I see actually happening in the pharmacy profession is, and I think social media has driven a lot of this, because organizations are following on social media. What happens on social media really matters to organizations now.
Yes.
And that is rather unfortunate and sad. And I was just going to say, what I see happening or has happened over the last 5 or 10 years is a real degradation of this notion of where your professional home is. you know who I'm talking about. There are organizations who have popped up and done really well, and the reputations of people that have, are running them has gone. So there's, if we talk about, you know, people's stock, like the stock market, there are a lot of people whose stock has gone up, you know, that's good for them. But the central place that we call sort of pharmacy home or pharmacist home, it doesn't really feel there. We've had the unionization of the profession as well. Now, you know, union, yeah, we could talk all day about whether that's a good or a bad thing. I think it's a necessary thing, I have to say, based on what's happening. But I think, is the PDA, for example, ever going to be the professional body? Well, no, by their own admission, they're not. And every time I've spoken to Mark Kozel, he says, even in private, vehemently, we are not a professional body. Absolutely not. So I believe him on that. But it just, well, how do you think we solve that, Addy? Like, how do we not suppress opinion or not let, you know, I want people to have their say and have their views, but there has to be some kind of order, doesn't there?
I think you're right, as you know, you're right, Johnny, and I think the challenge for us is because we have never come to agree a central agenda. Everybody is responding in their own different way to the same common threats, in one sense, but also worryingly, which is inherent in any sort of human sort of setup, is that some people are also pursuing just their own agendas. So we have a less commonly agreed professional agenda, but everybody's got their own agenda. So that could be their own security, their own status, their own favorite expression of how the profession should be. It all just kind of all runs. So there are different threads. And social media, you know, lends itself greatly to that sort of environment, because what happens is you have all these different trains, you know, going, you know, wheeling around each other, sometimes crashing into each other. You know, it's real good. It's a good spectre to, you know, to watch if, you know, there. But what it doesn't do, though, is it doesn't actually push anything forward. Nothing goes forward. It's just that there is a lot in, you know, of there. And I think where I think we all must come to is to first of all identify that maybe, you know, there is a mutual letting down. We've all let each other down. You know, I think there is a great disappointment in all of us about maybe how things are at the moment. And some of that is not because of choices that we have made. It's maybe some of it is legacy. But in that space, we then come to this common thing to say, okay, we need to try and make things better. Okay, we need to try and make everything. And there's lots of things to do. So what do we start from? You know, I would maybe argue that we need to do some work or maybe well-being and welfare and terms and things where the unionization comes in. Because actually, if not for the work of the unions, you know, some of the practices that you and I know used to exist before were terrible. You know, and they still do now. So we can. So there is that. But and I think there's got to be that. Now, professional leadership and representation itself now could be said that it should have always been just the one organization, but that's not where we are now. So we have to accept that. But again, almost agreeing what the agendas are. Can we? The difference is this, and this is, well, not the difference, but I think in one sense is our challenge is the rest of the world has certainly got its agendas for us, and they're not going to give us time and space to work out our own plans. So, and I think that lack of urgency is the core part of that. In that space, actually, we are certainly carried along by other agendas as well, whether that is corporate agendas, whether that, there's so many different ones of it. Now, if we are not centered on some core professional principles core values, what we are, what we do, what we offer, the non-negotiables for us, and the things that we treasure and protect. Well, we'll keep having people offering us, okay, you can get, we keep having trade-offs, or we will keep finding people who find a way through some of our own, and we don't have that. So that's why we do look much more, really much more isolated there. And the breaches that then happen are sometimes to get you from one situation into another situation. In one place where you're having maybe worse professional time, worse, then we can give you a break into somewhere else. But I think that should not be something that's happening almost like that should be things that should happen within the profession, and it's not there. So the future has got to be addressing those things. And community pharmacy, I can honestly say, is the place where some of the worst of these things has happened. And I don't think that people see enough of the best of us. It doesn't mean it's not there, but I certainly think, because of our place in the visibility of what who a pharmacist is, I think we have a greater responsibility to be able to then do that. But how do we do that in the conflicts that exist or in the interests that exist is also challenging. But we can't just talk about the challenges, because in each of those places, wherever it is, there is a pharmacist, there is a superintendent pharmacist. Whether you are in the largest multiple or in the there is this person who should be bold enough saying, oh, I can't allow, that's not how our profession is practiced. That's not how my colleagues will be treated. That's just it. And oh, that's not what we're going to do to our patients, because actually my profession will not forgive me for letting that happen. If we don't have those sort of core values shaping everything, it's almost as though it's the dominant voice of the pharmacist that is the problem sometimes. And so we need to then almost say, we need to agree, why haven't we had those strong voices there? And how do we do that? Because I think that worries me. Where are those strong voices? And the future that we need needs those strong voices, but it also needs ideas and needs a coming together. Because certainly the opportunities are there, but we need to shape them, not just take what's given to us all the time.
And thinking about some like future legislative changes. I mean, there's a lot of debate around, have the multiples helped or hindered community pharmacy? And there's always this balance between corporatization versus individualism and your little, very almost bespoke local community, independent community pharmacy versus what a branch of a multiple can deliver. And we don't need to go into the pros and cons of each, but suffice to say, for example, delivering a large project at scale is much easier through multiple versus the independent. So would you be in favor of sort of changing the market legislatively in terms of what I'm thinking of here is like limiting the number of pharmacies someone can own? Do you think that type of lever would help?
That's a good question. And I know that there are other countries that have used those sort of models there. I think it's true, Johnny. The reality is that our legal framework means that we cannot turn back. Free enterprise is a core British value there. So we will never go back on some of those things. So what we have ended up with now is really all the current models of pharmacy premises ownership. And but what we shouldn't do is that it shouldn't be that the model of ownership is detrimental to the profession. Because actually that doesn't do anything for the profession actually. And the professionals should say, okay, well, yes, I have a responsibility, certainly an allegiance to my employer or the, but ultimately, this is terrible, because at some point, if this current ownership structure swaps itself, sells out, bills out, does whatever I have done to help it to do that cannot be the trade-off for, oh, my profession has regressed as a result, or we haven't moved forward. And we're not the only profession that sits in the model of ownership structure that practices in healthcare like that. So we must also come back to say, why can it be that it is such a fundamental challenge sometimes for us? And we then go back and maybe see, because actually the first thing that happens with any other profession or healthcare professional is they hold on to their core values. They're non-negotiable. Okay, so we think, and I think too many times we haven't held up our core values. So because of that, as we've eroded our core values, we've created opportunities for other people to do things that they shouldn't do things
Good
to us
point.
that they shouldn't do. And I think we can't even blame them because they don't know, they didn't know that they couldn't or they shouldn't, and we have never told them. Is it a balance of power? But ultimately, no, it's not, because that's where our structures need to have been stronger. Our regulatory structures, representative structures, our core professional structures. We should look at some practices that can exist that would put another colleague's license, well-being, the ability to care for the patients, and those should be real red lines for us. The thing, if that happens, well, we are all going to stand up here, and then, because actually it is, we're not that profession. And I think, Johnny, when we look at the biggest threat for us as a community pharmacy, I think that's it, is that we're not that profession, that that's what we stand up for. So because that's not what we stand up for, we come together maybe against our funders and the paymasters and sometimes against regulators, but those are not value principled stands. Those are right stands, but they're not the core value about our profession. So what has been eroded by our not taking a stand never seems to match up with what even other people are doing to us, in my opinion. And I think, how do we then really embed that? And if because once we do that, I think if we did the audit of that, we will first of all maybe be shocked to find out that we don't really have those common grounds. It's maybe not the way pharmacists have been trained. It's not the way we look at each other. It's not the way we do. And if we don't change that, we will keep telling, sometimes looking at the other person and thinking, oh, but they're fair game. Maybe they're my competition, or whatever. And I think that there is some real fundamental almost insight into our shared professionalism and what that demands of us that isn't there. And I don't see us talking about that enough. I don't see us, and we don't seem to have organizations that have the kudos, the respect across the board to do that. And I think because of the very toxic nature of the way we do things, even individuals kind of just, dare not raise their head and think we shouldn't be doing that, because they get, oh, which side are you on? And then they run away.
Exactly.
So we are, that's the, that is where we face, and the, and where the weaknesses in that structure is most detrimental, certainly is community pharmacy. It is, and where we will pay the biggest price, and we have been paying the biggest price for it, is also community pharmacy, actually. So if we look back, we can see that. And so moving forward, I think for me, a future that understands that and actually defines those values and comes to ground it there, I think is going to start to underpin some things that we do, because the professionals feel protected, and they also have a sense of obligation to this, because they know what they're getting. I think too many of us are always looking after our own back, because we start off by thinking nobody's really looking out for me, and I think that's a horrible place to be, to think I'm giving everything, I'm doing the best for my patient, my employer, but nobody's really looking out for me. So I need to look out for myself. And if that becomes a core value of a profession, how does that progress?
Absolutely. It's very interesting what you said there. And it's a lot, I agree with you. A lot of it's finding that shared values. And I find these people, you know, the people running these littler organizations, I find it interesting because I'm sure in their minds they're doing, like, you know, for want of a better phrase, they're busting a gut to do the best they can for the profession. But actually, in the grand scheme of the ecosystem, they're actually possibly damaging it. You know, the sum of the part, what's that thing about the sum of the parts is greater than the whole and all that, or whatever. The can't remember what way around that is, but basically, if we work as a team, we'll get a better
Well,
outcome. And
and I think, Johnny, the challenge is if you feel as if you don't do it, nobody else is, or nobody else cares about it so much. And I think we almost have a complex of vulnerability. We are also aware of how vulnerable we are, that we're all doing something about it. You know, we're all doing something about it either way. So because you don't think anybody else is looking out for you, you know, and I think, you know, all the people doing that, I understand why, but I think how do we move forward with that sort of, you know, so the if you have a professional, so every, you know, when you start off with meeting with people who are not, you know, your pharmacist meeting people who are not pharmacists, and they go, "How are you doing? What do you think of your job?" I don't think you say glowing great things about it there.
No.
You know, you know, you literally are pitching for another career, get me out of here, rescue me, you know. And I think there are too many times that that's how many of us feel. And that's wrong. And it's not that person. We can't blame that individual. It's the culture in that profession. Now, and I think if we come to the point where we think that we are so powerless to save our own profession, then almost we're saying that we're so powerless to be, you know, to be a profession. Because ultimately that's what it is. And I think that's really starting will start to become an issue for us when you know, when we start to see the numbers of people maybe applying to join the profession dropping, or people who are joining the profession who do not share almost those unwritten values that we all kind of adhere to, you know, do all you can, you know, support your patients, do your, because we've taken them for granted. And that is a risk for us, Johnny, that I think is now much more at the fore for every one of us to really be thinking about, and for the future of the profession for us to really start to embrace that. Of course, underpinning all of those things of the progress will be, you know, technology use, you know, greater use of delegation and more powers to use and more opportunities to use clinical skills and that. But if you don't get those fundamentals right, well, one, it just means you don't get the right people in, and when you get them in, they don't stay. So you're never going to make any progress.
I do, I'm gonna pull it to a close. I mean, it's very interesting what you've said there, and it really speaks to my core opinion about all of this. And I suppose some people will watch this and think, oh, they're up in the clouds speaking about, you know, things that don't mean anything to me at the coal face. But actually, the politics of all this really matters, and where the power in our profession sits really matters. And whether we are actually a profession. You know, if we're a group of people who do not have the capability or the desire to decide on our own standards, decide on what is acceptable or not acceptable, decide on our practice basically collectively, and move forward with that, and rub up against, you know, challenge the regulator. I mean, that's something I don't see an awful lot of, Addy, in our profession. Is we should, in my opinion, we should be like, you know, that we should be challenging the regulator. I don't see an awful lot of that in the public, sorry, in the professional political sphere. You know, I would like to hear a narrative around the regulators holding us back, kind of thing. You know, why can't we do this kind of thing? You know, why can't we do X, Y, and Z? Why can't you change the law to to let pharmacists do this. And actually, this is why, because we've built these structures to make it, to protect the public from the practice that we're about to do. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's oversimplifying it.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Do you agree with that?
I think you have really seen what we all see is the result of those weaknesses that we've just kind of elaborated on, Johnny. Because those weaknesses exist, what you're then ending up with is situations where people look and see that and they feel as if they need to protect you, the pharmacist, and also the public. You know, there is almost so what they then do is they put barriers to say, well, we are protecting you because we see how vulnerable you are, and we need to also protect those that you are taking care of, the public as well. You know, and we just not bold enough, we just not strong enough there. And it seems as though that inherent sort of, and it is sometimes very, you know, paternalistic sort of approach to things there, but actually without it, we almost cannot articulate that we don't need it, but we are very good actually to showing why we need it. You know, we need it because, and I think that's it. We're so good to say, oh, do we really need it? But then we can demonstrate why we need it. There's so many good case examples, incidents to draw on of why it's needed. And I think that's why you don't see that pushback. Because, in truth, we're not even at the point yet where we are aspirational enough to feel that we're being curtailed by anybody else. We are almost
the point. That is the point, isn't it?
And I think in truth, because many of us have been almost, we feel that we need safeguarding. We see safeguarding from our own profession. So it's good that somebody else is looking after us. And again, we are so good at the trade-offs in thinking, okay, if I take this from you, what do I lose? Oh, that? Okay, I don't think that's too important, because we don't know that that's a core value. You know, it's a core value. So we and I think that's it. We need to define our core values, and we need to do it very soon. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that, you know, the weaknesses that exist, the structures, the way we do things, the fact that there is such a duplicity of representation is all because of these core things. And we almost need to come together and say, you know, we need to define that. And from that, that becomes the red lines. It brings into us a sense of professional esteem, safety, our offer to the public, it's a clear sort of message to the government and to our funders as well and policymakers that is what we bring. If you were to ask a policymaker, what does community pharmacy mean? I think the answer would be very different, because actually I don't think we have even been able to articulate that in a way there. Or what will community pharmacy not allow you to do to them? I think that's the core question. Up until people can know what community pharmacy will not allow you to do to them, then actually we will keep being shaped by events and agendas and responding to that and creating ways to safeguard ourselves continually. It's exhausting. And at some point, everybody just checks out.
But I think, you know, out of that, you and I are both like extremely positive people. let's not beat about the bush there. So, you know, for us to be reflecting in this way, and can I just say, I think the terms in which we've had this conversation, I hope, is positive and constructive. And, you know, for example, we haven't named names, or it's that no blame thing. It's no one's fault. It's just lots of things and circumstances and drivers in the market and in the ecosystem that have come together to bring us here. And I suppose that's a lot of why I decided to do this conference, is to sort of, you know, on one hand, understand a lot more about where we actually are and be, you know, have a place where we could be honest about that actually. And again, moving back to that progressive agenda, because if we just cherry picked, you know, to use a management speak term, the low-lying fruit, and And to be honest, I think vaccinations is in that low-lying fruit thing. I mean, every single pharmacy in the UK should be doing vaccinations, in my opinion. And it should be just like bread and butter. And there's a great argument for pharmacy technicians to be doing that and to be doing PGDs, in my opinion. The problem with that is if technicians do PGDs, well, what does a pharmacist do? That's a tough one. But anyway, I'm gonna draw it to a close. It's been a great chat. And sort of based on our last question, our last area of discussion, I think we've bottomed out in terms of what's wrong. But a couple of questions to finish, Addy, if I may. And one is, where do you see community pharmacy in 20 years' time? That's the first one. And the second one is, I know you're really enthusiastic about this, but we need a real pipeline into this profession, because if I'm honest, like, pharmacy's given me a great career, and I know it's tough. I've been there, without boohoo for me, but I have walked the streets looking for locum work. I walked around Belfast with my CVs in my hand and got a lot of, oh yeah, no. So I've done that. Started a business from scratch. I've done the locum thing where you go in and the place is an absolute tip, and it's completely stressful. I've done the management roles. I've also worked in GP practice. So pharmacy has given me, and I am in publishing, of course, so pharmacy has given me an amazing career. And I just wondered what your thoughts were around, what's in it for the next generation, and where do you see pharmacy in 20 years?
Oh, the pharmacy 20 years question is one that really bothers me a lot, Johnny, and I'll tell you why. I'm one of those people that promised myself that I will not look my child in the face and tell them, oh, don't go into pharmacy, don't, because you know why? My fear is that they're going to look at me and go, what were you doing all this time? If you know, what a waste of your life. So I think I expect them to do that. So I am completely committed into helping to help make things better and building those bridges. I think in 20 years' time, a lot will depend on how we sort out our structural weaknesses. If we still haven't been able to clearly define what our identity is, our values are, and what are there, I think what will happen is that, sadly, if we don't do that, we would have been sidelined into some sort of a sub-professional competency-based or skill-based performer in the health landscape. We will be the people that do stuff, because nobody is going to really remember what we are meant to be doing. We'll be the vaccinating people or the this people or the that, but what are we actually meant to be doing? Because that would have been, we would never have been able to articulate it, and other people have defined us to us, and that'll be based on their current agendas and their pressures. That's there. Now, if we get it right, I think that link that you set off with, that you started off with, Johnny, that wonderful thing that happens in community pharmacy where we are embedded in our communities, we deal with people there, the power of that really will be transformative. I mean, now we look at, one of my biggest regrets is that when we talk about like social prescribing should have been housed in community pharmacy. Many of us have
Absolutely.
been doing it for years. I've never got the funding. Why we were not able to create a primary care offer that brought social prescribing into general practice and community pharmacy is a worry for me, because I think if we cannot turn what we do, and we will never get paid for doing it, into something that is at least funded in a sustainable way, that's lost to us there. Now, the other question that you asked me, Johnny, was the question. So I've answered the first one about where we're going to get to, in 20 years. And then you, sorry to remind me again, you said,
What's in it for the next generation?
well, the next generation, I think the next generation, Johnny, will be, the next generation will be more, they are more clear what they want. So they have more options. They also are not going to be just be sold our sort of vision and our ideals. They will look at the realities of where we are. If we are still a place that is still trying to find themselves, if we are still, sidekicking with somebody else, they may think, actually, you know what? I'll just go and do something else. And then, or we end up becoming a vision, a place that brings people in and does not tell them you can innovate, you can be entrepreneurial, you can be adventurous, you can do whatever it takes to do the best for your patients. Now, if we don't become that, this sort of podcast in 20 years' time, people will listen to it or this video, and they'll listen to it and think, wow, I wonder where those guys were, because they won't believe that we were in this country, they won't believe that we were. That's it. And I think that'll be, they'll be thinking, well, that must have been a great place, because they would not be able to think there. So just to tell them, this is 2021, and we are in the UK, and what you're doing now is what we thought you would be doing. So, thanks to us, because I don't want them to listen back on us and think, well, oh, there must have been somewhere else. No, and we owe it to them that when they look back at this, they think, oh yeah, some people, this is why we're doing this. Not what a shame we couldn't get to that point.
Yeah, well, it's on the record now, Ari. So, the question is, will I be doing the Future Pharmacists Conference in 20 years' time? Who knows? Who knows what sort of global event that'll be? But one thing's for sure about the Future Pharmacist, that title's never going to go out of date.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it is, isn't it? So well done.
Anyway, it's been lovely speaking to you as ever. Very insightful, interesting conversation. And I really, really appreciate you coming to our first conference. It's
No, thank you
a
for
real
inviting me.
pleasure.
Thank you,
It's a
John.
pleasure. Thank you so much, Ali, and we'll see you soon, hopefully.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye.